Notice to creditors will be filed today and published in a local paper. I'll waive the bond. Inventory and accounting will be due pursuant to the statute. Ray had heard his father utter those same instructions 100 times. He glanced up at Judge Farr. Anything further, Mr. Vonner?
No, Your Honor.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Attlee, he said. Thank you, Your Honor. For lunch, they went to Claude's and ordered fried catfish. Ray had been back for 2 days, and he could already feel his arteries choking. Forrest had little to say. He was not clean, and his system was polluted. Ray's plans were vague. He wanted to visit some friends around the state, he said. There was no hurry to return to Virginia. Forrest left them after lunch, said he was going back to Memphis.
Will you be at Ellie's? Ray asked.
Maybe,
was his only reply. Ray was sitting on the porch, waiting for Claudia, when she arrived promptly at 5 p.m. He met her beside her car, where she stopped and looked at the realtor's for sale sign in the front yard near the street.
Do you have to sell it? She asked.
Either that or give it away. How are you?
I'm fine, Ray.
They managed to hug with just the minimum of contact. She was dressed for the occasion in slacks, loafers, a checkered blouse, and a straw hat, as if she'd just stepped from the garden. The lips were red, the mascara perfect. Ray had never seen her when she wasn't properly turned out.
I'm so glad you called,
she said as they slowly walked up the drive to the house. We went to court today, opened the estate.
I'm sorry. Must have been tough on you.
It wasn't too bad. I met Judge Farr.
Did you like him?
Nice enough, I guess, in spite of the history. He took her arm and led her up the steps, though Claudia was fit and could climb hills in spite of the 2 packs a day.
I remember when he was fresh out of law school, she said. Didn't know a plaintiff from a defendant. Reuben could have won that race, you know, if I'd been around.
Let's sit here, Ray said, pointing to 2 rockers.
You've cleaned up the place,
she said, admiring the porch. It's all Harry Rex. He's hired painters, roofers, a cleaning service. They had to sandblast the dust off the furniture. But you can breathe now.
Mind if I smoke, she said.
No, it didn't matter. She was smoking regardless.
I'm so happy you called, she said again, then lit a cigarette.
I have tea and coffee, Ray said.
Iced tea, please. Lemon and sugar,
she said and crossed her legs. She was perched in the rocker like a queen, waiting for her tea. Ray recalled the tight dresses and long legs of many years ago as she sat just below the bench, scribbling elegantly away in her shorthand, while every lawyer in the courtroom watched. They talked about the weather, as folks do in the South when there's a gap in the conversation, or when there's nothing else to talk about. She smoked and smiled a lot, truly happy to be remembered by Ray. She was clinging. He was trying to solve a mystery. They talked about Forrest and Harry Rex, 2 loaded topics, and when she'd been there for 30 minutes, Ray finally got to the point. We found some money, Claudia, he said, and let the words hang in the air. She absorbed them, analyzed them, and proceeded cautiously.
Where?
It was an excellent question. Found where, as in the bank with records and such. Found where, as in stuffed in the mattress with no trail. In his study. Cash. Left behind for some reason.
How much? She asked, but not too quickly.
100,000. He watched her face and eyes closely. Surprise registered, but not shock. He had a script, so he pressed on. His records are meticulous. Checks written, deposits, ledgers with every expense, and this money seems to have no source.
He never kept a lot of cash, she said slowly.
That's what I remember, too. I have no idea where it came from. Do you?
None,
she said with no doubts whatsoever.
The judge didn't deal in cash, period. Everything went through the First National Bank. He was on the board for a long time, remember?
Yes, very well. Did he have anything on the side?
Such as?
I'm asking you, Claudia. You knew him better than anyone, and you knew his business.
He was completely devoted to his work. To him, being a chancellor was a great calling, and he worked very hard at it. He had no time for anything else.
Including his family, Ray said, then immediately wished he had not.
He loved his boys, Ray, but he was from a different generation.
Let's stay away from that.
Let's.
They took a break, and each regrouped. Neither wanted to dwell on the family. The money had their attention. A car eased down the street and seemed to pause just long enough for the occupants to see the for sale sign and take a long look at the house. One look was enough because it sped away.
Did you know he was gambling? Ray asked.
The judge? No.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
Harry Rex took him to the casinos once a week for a while. Seems as if the judge had a knack for it and Harry Rex did not.
You hear rumors, especially about the lawyers. Several of them have gotten into trouble over there.
But you've heard nothing about the judge?
No, I still don't believe it.
The money came from somewhere, Claudia, and something tells me it was dirty. Otherwise, he would have included it with the rest of his assets.
And if he won at gambling, he would have considered that dirty, don't you think?
Indeed, she knew the judge better than anyone.
Yes, and you?
Sounds like Reuben Atlee to me.
They finished that round of conversation and took a break, both rocking gently in the cool shade of the front porch, as if time had stopped, neither bothered by the silence. Porch sitting allowed great lapses while thoughts were gathered, or while there was no thinking at all. Finally, Ray, still plodding through an unwritten script, mustered the courage to ask the toughest question of the day.
I need to know something, Claudia. And please be honest.
I'm always honest. It's one of my faults.
I have never questioned my father's integrity.
Nor should you now.
Help me out here, okay?
Go on.
Was there anything on the side? A little extra from a lawyer, a slice of the pie from a litigant, a nice backhander, as the Brits like to say?
Absolutely not.
I'm throwing darts, Claudia, hoping to hit something. You don't just find $100,000 in nice, crisp bills tucked away on a shelf. When he died, he had $6,000 in the bank. Why keep $100 buried?
He was the most ethical man in the world.
I believe that.
Then stop talking about bribes and such.
Gladly.
She lit another cigarette, and he left to fill up the tea glasses. When he returned to the porch, Claudia was deep in thought, her gaze stretching far beyond the street. They rocked for a while. Finally, he said, I think the judge would want you to have some of it.
Oh, you do?
Yes. We'll need some of it now to finish fixing up the place, probably $25,000 or so. What if you, me, and Forrest split the remainder?
25 each?
Yep. What do you think?
You're not running it through the estate, she asked.
She knew the law better than Harry Rex.
Why bother?
It's cash. Nobody knows about it. And if we report it, then half will go for taxes.
And how would you explain it? She asked,
as always one step ahead. They used to say that Claudia would have the case decided before the lawyers began their opening statements. And the woman loved money. Clothes, perfume, always a late model car, and all these things from a poorly paid court reporter. If she was drawing a state pension, it couldn't be much.
It cannot be explained, Ray said.
If it's from gambling, then you'll have to go back and amend his tax returns for the past years, she said, quickly on board. What a mess.
A real mess.
The mess was quietly put to rest. No one would ever know about her share of the money.
We had a case once, she said, gazing across the front lawn. Over in Tipper County, 30 years ago. A man named Childers owned a scrapyard. He died with no will.
A pause, a long drag on the cigarette.
Had a bunch of kids, and they found money hidden all over the place. In his office, in his attic, in a utility shed behind his house, in his fireplace. It was a regular Easter egg hunt. Once they'd scoured every inch of the place, they counted it up, and it was about $200,000. This from a man who wouldn't pay his phone bill and wore the same pair of overalls for 10 years.
Another pause, another long puff. She could tell these stories forever.
Half the kids wanted to split the money and run. The other half wanted to tell the lawyer and include the money in the probate. Word leaked out. The family got scared, and the money got added to the old man's estate. The kids fought bitterly. 5 years later, all the money was gone. Half to the government, half to the lawyers.
She stopped, and Ray waited for the resolution. "What's the point?" he asked.
The judge said it was a shame, said the kids should have kept the money quiet and split it. After all, it was the property of their father.
Sounds fair to me.
He hated inheritance taxes. Why should the government get a large portion of your wealth just because you die? I heard him grumble about it for years.
Ray took an envelope from behind his rocker and handed it to her. That's $25,000 in cash. She stared at it, then looked at him in disbelief. Take it, he said, inching it closer to her. No one will ever know. She took it and for a second was unable to speak. Her eyes watered, and for Claudia that meant serious emotions were at work.
Thank you,
she whispered, and clutched the money even tighter. Long after she left, Ray sat in the same chair, rocking in the darkness, quite pleased with himself for eliminating Claudia as a suspect. Her ready acceptance of $25,000 was convincing proof that she knew nothing of the much larger fortune. But there was no suspect to take her place on the list. Chapter 23. The meeting had been arranged through a Virginia law alumnus who was now a partner in a New York mega firm, which in turn was counsel to a gaming group that operated Canyon casinos across the country. Contacts had been made, favors exchanged, arms twisted slightly and very diplomatically. It was in the delicate area of security, and no one wanted to step over the line. Professor Attlee needed just the basics. Canyon had been on the Mississippi River in Tunica County since the mid-90s, arriving in the second wave of construction and surviving the first shakeout. It had 10 floors, 400 rooms, 80,000 square feet of gaming opportunities, and had been very successful with old Motown acts. Mr. Jason Piccolo, a vice president of some sort from the home office in Vegas, was on hand to greet Ray, and with him was Alvin Barker, head of security. Piccolo was in his early 30s and dressed like an Armani model. Barker was in his 50s and had the look of a weathered old cop in a bad suit. They began by offering a quick tour, which Ray declined. He had seen enough casino floors in the past month to last him forever. How much of the upstairs is off limits? He asked.
Well, let's see,
Piccolo said politely, and they led him away from the slots and tables to a hallway behind the cashier's booths. Up the stairs and down another hallway, and they stopped in a narrow room with a long wall of one-way mirrors. Through it, there was a large, low room filled with round tables covered with closed-circuit monitors. Dozens of men and women were glued to the screens, seemingly afraid to miss anything.
This is the eye in the sky, Piccolo was saying. Those guys on the left are watching the blackjack tables. In the center, craps and roulette. To the right, slots and poker.
And what are they watching?
Everything. Absolutely everything.
Give me the list.
Every player. We watch the big hitters, the pros, the card counters, the crooks. Take blackjack. Those guys over there can watch 10 hands and tell if a player is counting cards. That man in the gray jacket studies faces, looking for the serious players. They bounce around, here today, Vegas tomorrow, then they'll lay low for a week and surface in Atlantic City or the Bahamas. If they cheat or count cards, he'll spot them when they sit down.
Piccolo was doing the talking. Barker was watching Ray as if he might be a potential cheater. How close is the camera view? Ray asked.
Close enough to read the serial number of any bill. We caught a cheater last month because we recognized a diamond ring he had worn before.
Can I go in there?
Sorry.
What about the craps tables?
The same. It's a bigger problem because the game is faster and more complicated.
Are there professional cheaters at craps?
They're rare. Same with poker and roulette. Cheating is not a huge problem. We worry more about employee theft and mistakes at the table.
What kind of mistakes?
Last night a blackjack player won a $40 hand, but our dealer made a mistake and pulled the chips. The player objected and called the pit boss over. Our guys up here saw it happen and we corrected the situation.
How?
We sent a security guy down with instructions to pay the customers $40, give him an apology, and comp a dinner.
What about the dealer?
He has a good record, but one more screw-up and he's gone.
So everything's recorded?
Everything. Every hand, every throw of the dice, every slot. We have 200 cameras rolling right now.
Ray walked along the wall and tried to absorb the level of surveillance. There seemed to be more people watching above than gambling below.
How can a dealer cheat with all this? He asked, waving a hand.
Piccolo said,
There are ways,
and gave Barker a knowing look.
Many ways. We catch one a month.
Why do you watch the slots? Ray asked, changing the subject. He would kill some time scatter shooting since he had been promised only one visit upstairs.
Because we watch everything, Piccolo said, and because there have been some instances where miners won jackpots. The casinos refused to pay, and they won the lawsuits because they had video showing the miners ducking away while adults stepped in. Would you like something to drink?
Sure.
We have a secret little room with a better view.
Ray followed them up another flight of stairs to a small enclosed balcony with views of the gaming floor and the surveillance room. A waitress materialized from thin air and took their drink orders. Ray asked for cappuccino. Waters for his hosts.
What's your biggest security concern? Ray asked.
He was looking at a list of questions he'd pulled from his coat pocket.
Card counters and sticky-fingered dealers,
Piccolo answered.
Those little chips are very easy to drop into cuffs and pockets. $50 a day is $1,000 a month, tax-free, of course.
How many card counters do you see in here?
More and more. There are casinos in 40 states now, so more people are gambling. We keep extensive files on suspected counters, and when we think we have one here, then we simply ask them to leave. We have that right, you know.
What's your biggest one-day winner? Ray asked.
Piccolo looked at Barker, who said,
Excluding slots?
Yes.
We had a guy win $180 in craps one night.
$180,000?
Right.
And your biggest loser? Barker took his water from the waitress and scratched his face for a second.
Same guy dropped $200,000 three nights later.
Do you have consistent winners? Ray asked, looking at his notes as if serious academic research was underway.
I'm not sure what you mean, Piccolo said.
Let's say a guy comes in two or three times every week, plays cards or dice, wins more than he loses, and over time racks up some nice gains. How often do you see that?
It's very rare, said Piccolo. Otherwise we wouldn't be in business.
Extremely rare, Barker said. A guy might get hot for a week or two. We'll zero in on him, watch him real close, nothing suspicious. But he is taking our money. Sooner or later, he's going to take one chance too many, do something stupid, and we'll get our money back.
80% lose over time, Piccolo added.
Ray stirred his cappuccino and glanced at his notes. A guy walks in, complete stranger, lays down $1,000 on a blackjack table, and wants $100 chips. What happens up here? Barker smiled and cracked his thick knuckles.
We perk up. We'll watch him for a few minutes, see if he knows what he's doing. The pit boss will ask him if he wants to be raided or tracked, and if so, then we'll get his name. If he says no, then we'll offer him a dinner. The cocktail waitress will keep the drinks coming, but if he doesn't drink, then that's another sign that he might be serious. The pros never drink when they gamble, Piccolo added. They might order a drink for cover, but they'll just play with it.
What is raiding?
Most gamblers want some extras, explained Piccolo. Dinner, tickets to a show, room discounts, all kinds of goodies we can throw in. They have membership cards that we monitor to see how much they're gambling. The guy in your hypothetical has no card, so we'll ask him if he wants to be raided.
And he says no.
Then it's no big deal. Strangers come and go all the time.
But we sure try to keep up with them, Barker admitted.
Ray scribbled something meaningless on his folded sheet of paper.
"Do the casinos pool their surveillance?" he asked,
and for the first time Piccolo and Barker squirmed in unison.
"What do you mean by pool?"
Piccolo asked with a smile, which Ray returned, Barker quickly joining in. While all three were smiling, Ray said,
"Okay, another hypothetical about our consistent winner.
Let's say the guy plays one night at the Monte Carlo, the next night at Treasure Cove, the next night at Aladdin, and so on down the strip here. He works all the casinos, and he wins a lot more than he loses. And this goes on for a year. How much will you know about this guy?"
Piccolo nodded at Barker, who was pinching his lips between a thumb and an index finger.
"We'll know a lot," he admitted.
"How much?" Ray pressed.
"Go on," Piccolo said to Barker, who reluctantly began talking.
"We'll know his name, his address, his occupation, phone number, automobile, bank. We'll know where he is each night, when he arrives, when he leaves, how much he wins or loses, how much he drinks, did he have dinner, did he tip the waitress, and if so, then how much? How much did he tip the dealer?"
"And you keep records on these people?"
Barker looked at Piccolo, who nodded yes, very slowly, but said nothing. They were clamming up because he was getting too close. On second thought, a tour was just what he needed. They walked down to the floor, where instead of looking at the tables, Ray was looking up at the cameras. Piccolo pointed out the security people. They stood close to a blackjack table, where a kid who seemed like a young teenager was playing with stacks of $100 chips.
"He's from Reno," Piccolo whispered. "Hit Tunica last week. Took us for $30,000. Very, very good." "And he doesn't count cards," Barker whispered, joining the conspiracy. "Some people just have the talent for it, like golf or heart surgery,"
Piccolo said. "Is he working all the casinos?" Ray asked.
"Not yet, but they're all waiting for him."
The kid from Reno made both Barker and Piccolo very nervous. The visit was finished in a lounge where they drank sodas and wrapped things up. Ray had completed his list of questions, all of which had been leading up to the grand finale.
"I have a favor," he asked the two of them.
"Sure, anything."
"My father died a few weeks ago, and we have reason to believe he was sneaking over here, shooting dice, perhaps winning a lot more than he was losing. Can this be confirmed?"
"What was his name?"
asked Barker.
"Reuben Attlee from Clanton."
Barker shook his head no while pulling a phone from his pocket.
"How much?"
asked Piccolo.
"Don't know. Maybe $1 million over a period of years."
Barker was still shaking his head.
"No way. Anybody who wins or loses that kind of money, we'll know him well."
And then into the phone, Barker asked the person on the other end if he could check on a Reuben Attlee.
"You think he won $1 million?
Piccolo asked.
"Won and lost," Ray replied.
"Again, we're just guessing."
Barker slammed his phone shut. "No record of any Reuben Attlee anywhere. There's no way he gambled that much around here."
"What if he never came to this casino?" Ray asked, certain of the answer.
"We would know,"
they said together.
Chapter 24 He was the only jogger in Clanton, and for this he got curious stares from the ladies in their flower beds, and the maids sweeping the porches, and the summer help cutting grass at the cemetery when he ran past the Attlee family plot. The soil was settling around the judge, but Ray did not stop or even slow down to inspect it. The men who had dug the grave were digging another. There was a death and a birth every day in Clanton. Things changed little. It was not yet 8 o'clock, and the sun was hot and the air heavy. The humidity didn't bother him because he had grown up with it, but he certainly didn't miss it either. He found the shaded streets and worked his way back to Maple Run. Forrest's jeep was there, and his brother was slouched in the swing on the porch.
"Kind of early for you, isn't it?" Ray said.
"How far did you run? You're covered in sweat."
"That happens when you jog in the heat. 5 miles. You look good."
And he did. Clear, unswollen eyes, a shave, a shower, clean white painter's pants.
"I'm on the wagon, bro."
"Wonderful."
Ray sat in a rocker, still sweating, still breathing heavily. He would not ask how long Forrest had been sober. Couldn't have been more than 24 hours.
Forrest bounced from the swing and pulled the other rocker near Ray.
"I need some help, bro," he said, sitting on the edge of the chair.
"Here we go again," Ray said to himself. "I'm listening."
"I need some help,"
he blurted again, rubbing his hands fiercely as if the words were painful. Ray had seen it before and had no patience.
"Let's go, Forrest. What is it?"
It was money, first of all. After that, there were several possibilities.
"There's a place I want to go, about an hour from here. It's way out in the woods, close to nothing. Very pretty. A nice little lake in the center. Comfortable rooms."
He pulled a wrinkled business card from his pocket and handed it to Ray. "Alcorn Village Drug and Alcohol Treatment Facility. A ministry of the Methodist Church."
"Who's Oscar Meave?" Ray asked, looking at the card.
"A guy I met a few years ago. He helped me. Now he's at that place."
"It's a detox center?"
"Detox, rehab, drug unit, dryout tank, spa, ranch, village, jail, prison, mental ward, call it whatever you want. I don't care. I need help, Ray. Now."
He covered his face with his hands and began crying.
"Okay, okay," Ray said. "Give me the details."
Forrest wiped his eyes and his nose and sucked in a heavy load of air.
"Call the guy and see if they have a room," he said, his voice quivering.
"How long will you stay?"
4 weeks, I think. But Oscar can tell you."
"And what's the cost?"
"Somewhere around $300 a day. I was thinking maybe I could borrow against my share of this place, get Harry Rex to ask the judge if there's a way to get some money now."
Tears were dripping from the corners of his eyes. Ray had seen the tears before. He had heard the pleas and the promises, and no matter how hard and cynical he tried to be at that moment, he melted.
"We'll do something," he said. "I'll call this guy now."
"Please, Ray. I want to go right now."
"Today?"
"Yes, well, I can't go back to Memphis."
He lowered his head and ran his fingers through his long hair. "Somebody looking for you?"
"Yeah," he nodded. "Bad guys."
"Not cops?"
"No, they're a hell of a lot worse than cops."
"Do they know you're here?" Ray asked, glancing around. He could almost see heavily armed drug dealers hiding behind the bushes.
"No, they have no idea where I am."
Ray stood and went into the house. Like most folks, Oscar Meave remembered Forrest well. They had worked together in a federal detox program in Memphis, and while he was sad to hear that Forrest was in need of help, he was nonetheless delighted to talk to Ray about him. Ray tried his best to explain the urgency of the matter, though he had no details and was not likely to get any. Their father had died 3 weeks earlier, Ray said, already making excuses.
"Bring him on," Meave said. "We'll find a place."
They left town 30 minutes later in Ray's rental car. Forrest's Jeep was parked behind the house for good measure.
"Are you sure these guys won't be snooping around here?" Ray said.
"They have no idea where I'm from," Forrest replied.
His head was back on the headrest, his eyes hidden behind funky sunshades.
"Who are they exactly?"
"Some really nice guys from South Memphis. You'd like them."
"And you owe them money?"
"Yes."
"How much?"
$4,000.
"And where did this $4,000 go?"
Forrest gently tapped his nose. Ray shook his head in frustration and anger and bit his tongue to hold back another bitter lecture. Let some miles pass, he told himself. They were in the country now, farmland on both sides. Forrest began snoring. This would be another Forrest tale. The third time Ray actually loaded him up and hauled him away for detox. The last time had been almost 12 years earlier. The judge was still presiding, Claudia still at his side, Forrest doing more drugs than anyone in the state. Things had been normal. The narcs had cast a wide net around him, and through blind luck Forrest had sneaked through it. They suspected he was dealing, which was true, and had they caught him he would still be in prison. Ray had driven him to a state hospital near the coast, one the judge had pulled strings to get him into. There he slept for a month, then walked away. The first brotherly journey to rehab had been during Ray's law school years at Tulane. Forrest had overdosed on some vile combination of pills. They pumped his stomach and almost pronounced him dead. The judge sent them to a compound near Knoxville with locked gates and razor wire. Forrest stayed a week before escaping. He had been to jail twice, once as a juvenile, once as an adult, though he was only 19. His first arrest was just before a high school football game, Friday night, the playoffs, in Clanton with the entire town waiting for kickoff. He was 16, a junior, an all-conference quarterback and safety, a kamikaze who loved to hit late and spear with his helmet. The narcs plucked him from the dressing room and led him away in handcuffs. The backup was an untested freshman, and when Clanton got slaughtered, the town never forgave Forrest Atlee. Ray had been sitting in the stands with the judge, anxious as everyone else about the game. "Where's Forrest?" folks began asking during pregame. When the coin was tossed, he was in the city jail getting fingerprinted and photographed. They found 14 ounces of marijuana in his car. He spent 2 years in a juvenile facility and was released on his 18th birthday. How does the 16-year-old son of a prominent judge become a dope pusher in a small southern town with no history of drugs? Ray and his father had asked each other that question 1,000 times. Only Forrest knew the answer, and long ago he had made the decision to keep it to himself. Ray was thankful that he buried most of his secrets. After a nice nap, Forrest jolted himself awake and announced he needed something to drink. "No," Ray said. "A soft drink, I swear." They stopped at a country store and bought sodas. For breakfast, Forrest had a bag of peanuts. "Some of these places have good food," he said when they were moving again. Forrest, the tour guide for detox centers. Forrest, the Michelin critic for rehab units. "I usually lose a few pounds," he said, chomping. "Do they have gyms and such?" Ray asked, aiding the conversation. He really didn't want to discuss the perks of various drug tanks.
"Some do," Forrest said smugly. "Ellie sent me to this place in Florida near a beach. Lots of sand and water. Lots of sad, rich folks. 3 days of brainwashing, then they worked our asses off. Hikes, bikes, power walks, weights if we wanted. I got a great tan and dropped 15 pounds. Stayed clean for 8 months.
In his sad little life, everything was measured by stints of sobriety. "Ellie sent you?" Ray asked.
"Yeah, it was years ago. She had a little dough at one point, not much. I'd hit the bottom, and it was back when she cared. It was a nice place, though. And some of the counselors were those Florida chicks with short skirts and long legs.
I'll have to check it out."
"Kiss my ass. Just kidding. There's this place out west where all the stars go, the Hacienda, and it's the Ritz. Plush rooms, spas, daily massages, chefs who can fix great meals at 1,000 calories a day. And the counselors are the best in the world. That's what I need, bro. 6 months at the Hacienda."
"Why 6 months?"
"Because I need 6 months. I've tried 2 months, 1 month, 3 weeks, 2 weeks. It's not enough. For me, it's 6 months of total lockdown, total brainwashing, total therapy, plus my own masseuse."
"What's the cost?"
Forrest whistled and rolled his eyes. "Pick a number, I don't know. You gotta have $1 zillion and 2 recommendations to get in. Imagine that, a letter of recommendation. To the fine folks at the Hacienda, I hereby heartily recommend my friend Doofus Smith as a patient in your wonderful facility. Doofus drinks vodka for breakfast, snorts coke for lunch, snacks on heroin, and is usually comatose by dinner. His brain is fried, his veins are lacerated, his liver is shot to hell. Doofus is your kind of person, and his old man owns Idaho."
"Do they keep people for 6 months?"
"You're clueless, aren't you?"
"I guess.
A lot of cokeheads need a year. Even more for heroin addicts."
"And which is your current poison?" Ray wanted to ask. But then he didn't want to. "A year?" he said.
"Yep. Total lockdown. And then the addict has to do it himself. I know guys who've been to prison for 3 years with no coke, no crack, no drugs at all. And when they were released, they call the dealer before they call their wives or girlfriends."
"What happens to them?"
"It's not pretty."
He threw the last of the peanuts into his mouth, slapped his hands together, and sent salt flying. There were no signs directing traffic to Alcorn Village. They followed Oscar's directions until they were certain they were lost deep in the hills, then saw a gate in the distance. Down a tree-lined drive, a complex spread before them. It was peaceful and secluded, and Forrest gave it good marks for first impressions. Oscar Meave arrived in the lobby of the administration building and guided them to an intake office where he handled the initial paperwork himself. He was a counselor, an administrator, a psychologist, an ex-addict who'd cleaned himself up years ago and received 2 PhDs. He wore jeans, a sweatshirt, sneakers, a goatee, and 2 earrings, and had the wrinkles and chipped tooth of a rough prior life. But his voice was soft and friendly. He exuded the tough compassion of one who'd been where Forrest was now. The cost was $325 a day, and Oscar was recommending a minimum of 4 weeks.
After that, we'll see where he is. I'll need to ask some pretty rough questions about what Forrest has been doing.
I don't want to hear that conversation, Ray said.
You won't, Forrest said.
He was resigned to the flogging that was coming.
And we require half the money up front, Oscar said. The other half before his treatment is complete.
Ray flinched and tried to remember the balance in his checking account back in Virginia. He had plenty of cash, but this was not the time to use it.
The money's coming out of my father's estate, Forrest said. It might take a few days.
Oscar was shaking his head.
No exceptions. Our policy is half now.
No problem, said Ray. I'll write a check for it.
I want it to come out of the estate, Forrest said. You're not paying for it.
The estate can reimburse me. It'll work. Ray wasn't sure how it would work, but he'd let Harry Rex worry about that. He signed the forms as guarantor of payment. Forrest signed at the bottom of a page, listing all the do's and don'ts.
You can't leave for 28 days, Oscar said. If you do, you forfeit all monies paid, and you're never welcome back. Understand?
I understand, Forrest said. How many times had he been through this?
You're here because you want to be here, right?
Right.
And no one is forcing you.
No one. Now that the flogging was on, it was time for Ray to leave. He thanked Oscar and hugged Forrest, and sped away much faster than he had arrived. Chapter 25. Ray was now certain that the cash had been collected since 1991. The year the judge was voted out of office. Claudia was around until the year before, and she knew nothing of the money. It had not come from graft, and it had not come gambling. Nor had it come from skillful investing on the sly, because Ray found not a single record of the judge ever buying or selling a stock or a bond. The accountant hired by Harry Rex to reconstruct the records and put together the final tax return had found nothing either. He said that the judge's trail was easy to follow because everything had been run through the First National Bank of Clanton. That's what you think, Ray thought to himself. There were almost 40 boxes of old, useless files scattered throughout the house. The cleaning service had gathered and stacked them in the judge's study and in the dining room. It took a few hours, but he finally found what he was looking for. 2 of the boxes held the notes and research, the trial files, as the judge had always referred to them, of the cases he had heard as a special chancellor since his defeat in 1991. During a trial, the judge wrote nonstop on yellow legal pads. He noted dates, times, relevant facts, anything that would aid him in reaching a final opinion in the case. Often he would interject a question to a witness, and he frequently used his notes to correct the attorneys. Ray had heard him quip more than once in chambers, of course, that the note-taking helped him stay awake. During a lengthy trial, he would fill 20 legal pads with his notes. Because he was a lawyer before he was a judge, he had acquired the lifelong habit of filing and keeping everything. A trial file consisted of his notes, copies of cases the attorneys relied on, copies of code sections, statutes, even pleadings that were not put with the official court file. As the years passed, the trial files became even more useless, and now they filled 40 boxes. According to his tax returns, Since 1993, he had picked up income, trying cases as special chancellor, cases no one else wanted to hear. It was not uncommon in the rural areas to have a dispute too hot for an elected judge. One side would file a motion asking the judge to recuse himself, and he would go through the routine of grappling with the issue while proclaiming his ability to be fair and impartial, regardless of the facts or litigants, then reluctantly step down and hand it off to an old pal from another part of the state. The special chancellor would ride in without the baggage of any prior knowledge and without one eye on re-election and hear the case. In some jurisdictions, special chancellors were used to relieve crowded dockets. Occasionally they would sit in for an ailing judge. Almost all were retired themselves. The state paid them $50 an hour, plus expenses. In 1992, the year after his defeat, Judge Attlee had earned nothing extra. In 1993, he had been paid $5,800. The busiest year, 1996, he had reported $16,300. Last year, 1999, he was paid $8,760, but he had been ill most of the time. The grand total in earnings as a special chancellor was $56,590 over a six-year period, and all earnings had been reported on his tax returns. Ray wanted to know what kinds of cases Judge Attlee had heard in his last years. Harry Rex had mentioned one, the sensational divorce trial of a sitting governor. That trial file was 3 inches thick and included clippings from the Jackson newspaper with photos of the governor, his soon-to-be ex-wife, and a woman thought to be his current flame. The trial lasted 2 weeks, and Judge Attlee, according to his notes, seemed to enjoy it tremendously. There was an annexation case near Hattiesburg that lasted for 2 weeks and had irritated everyone involved. The city was growing westward and eyeing some prime industrial sites. Lawsuits got filed, and 2 years later, Judge Attlee gathered everyone together for a trial. There were also newspaper articles, but after an hour of review, Ray was bored with the whole mess. He couldn't imagine presiding over it for a month. But at least there was money involved in it. Judge Attlee spent 8 days in 1995 holding court in the small town of Kosciuszko, 2 hours away. But from his files, it looked as though nothing of consequence went to trial. There was a horrendous tanker truck collision in Tishomingo County in 1994. 5 teenagers were trapped in a car and burned to death. Since they were minors, Chancery Court had jurisdiction. One sitting chancellor was related to one of the victims. The other chancellor was dying of brain cancer. Judge Attlee got the call and presided over a trial that lasted 2 days before it was settled for $7,400,000. One-third went to the attorneys for the teenagers, the rest to their families. Ray set the file on the judge's sofa next to the annexation case. He was sitting on the floor of the study, the newly polished floor, under the vigilant gaze of General Forrest. He had a vague idea of what he was doing, but no real plan on how to proceed. Go through the files, pick out the ones that involved money, see where the trial might lead. The cash he had found hidden less than 10 feet away had come from somewhere. His cell phone rang. It was a Charlottesville alarm company with a recorded message that a break-in was in progress at his apartment. He jumped to his feet and talked to himself while the message finished. The same call would simultaneously go to the police and to Corey Crawford. Seconds later, Crawford called him. "I'm on the way there," he said, and sounded like he was running. It was almost 9:30 CST, 10:30 in Charlottesville. Ray paced through the house, thoroughly helpless. 15 minutes passed before Crawford called him again. "I'm here," he said, "with the police. Somebody jammed the door downstairs, then jammed the one to the den. That set off the alarm. They didn't have much time. Where do we check?" "There's nothing particularly valuable there," Ray said, trying to guess what a thief might want. "No cash, jewelry, art, hunting rifles, gold, or silver." "TV, stereo, microwave, everything's here," Crawford said. "They scattered books and magazines, knocked over the table by the kitchen phone, but they were in a hurry.
Anything in particular?
No, nothing I can think of. Ray could hear a police radio squawking in the background.
How many bedrooms? Crawford asked as he moved through the apartment.
Two. Mine is on the right.
All the closet doors are open.
They were looking for something. Any idea what?
No, Ray answered.
No sign of entry in the other bedroom, Crawford reported, then began talking with two cops.
Hang on, he told Ray, who was standing in the front door, looking through the screen, motionless, and trying to think of the fastest way home. The cops and Crawford decided it was a quick strike by a pretty good thief who got surprised by the alarm. He jammed the two doors with minimal damage, realized there was an alarm, raced through the place looking for something in particular, and when he didn't find it, he kicked a few things for the hell of it and fled. He or they could have been more than one.
You need to be here to tell the police if anything is missing, and to do a report, Crawford said.
I'll be there tomorrow, Ray said. Can you secure the place tonight?
Yeah, we'll think of something.
Call me after the cops leave. He sat on the front steps and listened to the crickets while yearning to be at Cheney's self-storage, sitting in the dark with one of the judge's guns, ready to blast away at anyone who came near him. 15 hours away by car, 3.5 by private plane. He called Fogg Newton, and there was no answer. His phone startled him again.
I'm still in the apartment, Crawford said.
I don't think this is random, Ray said.
You mentioned some valuables, some family stuff at Cheney's self-storage?
Yeah. Any chance you could watch the place tonight?
They got security out there. Guards and cameras. Not a bad outfit.
Crawford sounded tired and not enthusiastic about napping in a car all night.
Can you do it?
I can't get in the place. You have to be a customer.
Watch the entrance.
Crawford grunted and breathed deeply.
Yeah, I'll check on it. Maybe call a guy in to watch it.
Thanks. I'll call you when I get to town tomorrow.
He called Cheney's and there was no answer. He waited 5 minutes, called again, counted 14 rings, then heard a voice.
Cheney's security. Murray speaking.
He very politely explained who he was and what he wanted. He was leasing 3 units, and there was a bit of concern because someone had vandalized his downtown apartment, and could Mr. Murray please pay special attention to 14B, 37F, and 18R? No problem, said Mr. Murray, who sounded as if he was yawning into the phone.
Just a little jumpy, Ray explained.
No problem,
mumbled Mr. Murray. It took 1 hour and 2 drinks for the edginess to relent. He was no closer to Charlottesville. There was the urge to hop in the rental car and race through the night, but it passed. He preferred to sleep and try to find an airplane in the morning. Sleep, though, was impossible, so he returned to the trial files. The judge had once said he knew little about zoning law because there was so little zoning in Mississippi, and virtually none in the 6 counties of the 25th Chancery District. But somehow someone had cajoled him into hearing a bitterly fought zoning case in the city of Columbus. The trial lasted for 6 days, and when it was over, an anonymous phone caller threatened to shoot the judge, according to his notes. Threats were not uncommon, and he'd been known to carry a pistol in his briefcase over the years. It was rumored that Claudia carried one, too. You'd rather have the judge shooting at you than his court reporter, ran the conventional wisdom. The zoning case almost put Ray to sleep. But then he found a gap, the black hole he'd been digging for, and he forgot about sleep. According to his tax records, the judge was paid $8,110 in January 1999 to hear a case in the 27th Chancery District. The 27th comprised 2 counties on the Gulf Coast, a part of the state the judge cared little for. The fact that he would voluntarily go there for a period of days struck Ray as quite odd. Odder still was the absence of a trial file. He searched the 2 boxes and found nothing related to a case on the coast, and with his curiosity barely under control, he plowed through the other 38 or so. He forgot about his apartment and the self-storage and whether or not Mr. Murray was awake or even alive and he almost forgot about the money. A trial file was missing. Chapter 26. The U.S. Air flight left Memphis at 6:40 in the morning, which meant Ray had to leave Clanton no later than 5, which meant he slept about 3 hours, the usual at Maple Run. On the first flight, he dozed off en route, again in the Pittsburgh airport, and again on the commuter flight to Charlottesville. He inspected his apartment, then fell asleep on the sofa. The money hadn't been touched. No unauthorized entries into any of his little storage units at Cheney's. Nothing was out of the ordinary. He locked himself inside 18R, opened the 5 fireproof and waterproof boxes, and counted 53 freezer bags. Sitting on the concrete floor with $3 million strewn around him, Ray Attlee finally admitted how important the money had become. The real horror of last night had been the chance of losing it. Now he was afraid to leave it. In the past few weeks, he had become more curious about how much things cost, about what the money could buy, about how it could grow if invested conservatively or aggressively. At times he thought of himself as wealthy, and then he would dismiss those thoughts. But they were always there, just under the surface, and popping up with greater frequency. The questions were slowly being answered. No, it was not counterfeit. No, it was not traceable. No, it had not been won at the casinos. No, it had not been filched from the lawyers and litigants of the 25th Chancery District. And no, the money should not be shared with Forrest, because he would kill himself with it. No, it should not be included in the estate for several excellent reasons. One by one, the options were being eliminated. He might be forced to keep it himself. There was a loud knock on the metal door, and he almost screamed. He scrambled to his feet and yelled, "Who is it?" "Security," came the reply, and the voice was vaguely familiar. Ray stepped over the cash and reached for the door, which he cracked no more than 4 inches. Mr. Murray was grinning at him. "Everything okay in there?" he asked, more of a janitor than an armed guard. "Fine, thanks," Ray said, his heart still frozen.
"Need anything, let me know."
"Thanks for last night."
"Just doing my job."
Ray repacked the money, relocked the doors, and drove across town with one eye on the rearview mirror. The owner of his apartment sent a crew of Mexican carpenters around to repair the 2 damaged doors. They hammered and sawed throughout the late afternoon, then said yes to a cold beer when they were finished. Ray chatted with them as he tried to ease them out of his den. There was a pile of mail on the kitchen table, and after ignoring it for most of the day, he sat down to deal with it. Bills had to be paid, catalogs and junk mail, 3 notes of sympathy. A letter from the Internal Revenue Service, addressed to Mr. Ray Attlee, executor of the estate of Reuben V. Attlee, and postmarked in Atlanta 2 days earlier. He studied it carefully before opening it slowly. A single sheet of official stationery from one Martin Gage, Office of Criminal Investigations, in the Atlanta office. It read, "Dear Mr. Attlee, as executor of your father's estate, you are required by law to include all assets for valuation and taxation purposes. Concealment of assets may constitute tax fraud. The unauthorized disbursement of assets is a violation of the laws of Mississippi and possible federal laws as well. Martin Gage, Criminal Investigator." His first instinct was to call Harry Rex to see what notice had been given to the IRS. As executor, he had a year from the date of death to file the final return, and according to the accountant, extensions were liberally granted. The letter was postmarked the day after he and Harry Rex went to court to open the estate. Why would the IRS be so quick to respond? How would they even know about the death of Reuben Attlee? Instead, he called the office number on the letterhead. The recorded message welcomed him to the world of the IRS Atlanta office, but he would have to call back later because it was a Saturday. He went online and in the Atlanta directory found 3 Martin Gages. The first one he called was out of town, but his wife said he did not work for the IRS, thank heavens. The second call went unanswered. The third found a Mr. Gage eating dinner. "Do you work for the IRS?" Ray asked after cordially introducing himself as a professor of law and apologizing for the intrusion.
"Yes, I do."
"Criminal investigations?"
"Yep, that's me. 14 years now."
Ray described the letter, then read it verbatim.
"I didn't write that," Gage said.
"Then who did?" Ray snapped and immediately wished he had not.
"How am I supposed to know? Can you fax it to me?"
Ray stared at his fax machine and, thinking quickly, said, "Sure, but my machine is at the office. I can do it Monday."
"Scan it and email it," Gage said.
My scanner's broke right now. I'll just fax it to you Monday."
"Okay, but somebody's pulling your leg, pal. That's not my letter."
Ray was suddenly anxious to rid himself of the IRS, but Gage was now fully involved.
"I'll tell you something else," he continued. "Impersonating an IRS agent is a federal offense, and we prosecute vigorously. Any idea who it is?"
"I have no idea."
"Probably got my name from our online directory. Worst thing we ever did. Freedom of information and all that crap."
"Probably so."
"When was the estate opened?"
3 days ago."
3 days ago? The return's not due for a year."
"I know."
"What's in the estate?"
"Nothing, an old house."
"Just some crackpot. Fax it Monday and I'll give you a call."
"Thanks." Ray put the phone on the coffee table and asked himself why exactly had he called the IRS. To verify the letter. Gage would never get a copy of it, and in a month or so he would forget about it, and in a year he wouldn't recall it if anyone mentioned it. Perhaps not the smartest move so far. Forrest had settled into the routine of Alcorn Village. He was allowed 2 calls a day, and they were subject to being recorded, he explained.
"They don't want us calling our dealers."
"Not funny," Ray said. It was the sober Forrest, with the soft drawl and clear mind.
"Why are you in Virginia?" he asked.
"It's my home."
"Thought you were visiting some friends around here. Old buddies from law school."
"I'll be back shortly."
"How's the food?"
"Like a nursing home.
Jell-O 3 times a day, but always a different color. Really lousy stuff. For $300 plus a day, it's a rip-off."
"Any cute girls?"
"One, but she's 14. Daughter of a judge, if you can believe that. Really some sad people. We have these group bitch meetings once a day where everyone lashes out at whoever got them started on drugs. We talk through our problems. We help one another. Hell, I know more than the counselors. This is my 8th detox, bro. Can you believe it?"
"Seems like more than that," Ray said.
"Thanks for helping me. You know what's sick?"
"What?"
"I'm happiest when I'm clean. I feel great. I feel smart. I can do anything. Then I hate myself when I'm on the streets doing all that stupid stuff like the other scumbags. I don't know why I do it."
"You sound great, Forrest."
"I like this place, aside from the food."
"Good. I'm proud of you.
Can you come see me?"
"Of course I will. Give me a